WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. During last night's presidential debate, Ann Compton asked each of the candidates for their definition of family. My guest, Stephanie Kuhns, is a historian of the American family. And she says many of our images of traditional family life are myths. Families have always been in flux and often in crisis and have never lived up to nostalgic notions about the way things used to be. Kuhns is the author of The Way We Never Were, American Families and the Nostalgia Trip. She teaches at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. I asked her if she thinks it makes sense to include family values on the political agenda.
Family values don't even make sense to me as something that I can define. You know, the whole phrase was not even used first until 1976. It's a phrase that would leave traditional Republicans with a small r kind of scratching their head and wondering what's going on. I've looked around for definitions since I can't find them in the past. And one of the spokesmen of for family values said, for example, in the Washington Post, that family values is how we feel about parenting, marriage, and sexuality. And what strikes me as a historian is what a tremendously truncated definition of morality that is. By that definition, organized crime families are among our leading moral exemplars.
What do you mean?
Well, they are definitely believe in chastity before marriage, long-lasting marriages, intergenerational bonds, a lot of loyalty. I'm disturbed by the way family values in this campaign has become a substitute for discussing more substantive issues of justice and distribution and even, yes, morality. But morality is not just something that goes on in our sex lives. It has to do with the way the society relates with each other.
What do you think family values have become such a subject of discussion now?
There are two reasons I think that family values are hot. First of all, I think for some time we've seen building a new social Darwinism of the 1990s, which blames poverty and unemployment and urban decay on the so-called collapse of the family. I think that's false. I think we should get into that if we have time to do so. The second reason that it's hot is because politicians are looking, of course, for ways to tap into people's immediate emotions on things by looking at polls. And I think the Republican strategists made a big mistake. They saw the polls that showed that 75% of Americans think there is a moral issue in America, are concerned about the family, and they erroneously concluded that those same people would then buy into a simplistic campaign based on moralism. As it turns out, they were wrong. Most Americans can simultaneously believe that there are moral issues and things to worry about in the family and still be opposed to attempts to impose one rigid family norm on Americans or to force women back into their so-called traditional roles.
In your book, you make the point that historically Americans have become most preoccupied with personal morality and family organization when they've felt overwhelmed by harder issues of public morality and social organization. What's an example of that?
Well, the American tradition of individualism makes it very difficult for us to discuss ideas and structural changes that are not caused by individual character flaws. And so there's continually a temptation in America when we have a growing gap between rich and poor or a discontinuity between our economic and political ideology and the reality, to look for things in people's individual lives that can explain that. And that's why whenever there's been a major change in the way we reproduce ourselves socially and economically, it's often been experienced as a personal change. Good example would be at the end of the 19th century, with a new mass consumer society, new immigrants, problems with slums as America became urban, new kinds of economic dislocations. Then, as now, there was a tremendous campaign to blame all these things on people's family failures. just as then as now, there was an attempt to say that if only women would take care of all of the obligations and dependencies of this changing society, we'd be okay. That was the period when they first criminalized abortion, which had previously been legal. And the same sort of rhetoric that we're getting now about women's selfish individualism prevailed then.
You make the point that the traditional American family, the way it's conceived of now, never exactly existed, that concept of the traditional family really is a mix of different types of families that come from different historical periods. For instance, you say that the image of the mother as being totally available to her children comes from one historical period of the family, and the image of, like, the parents being this truly always in love, sexually involved couple comes from another image of the family. And let me ask you to put the pieces of this together.
Well, we have kind of mushed together all of these ideas that a man's home was his castle, there was once a time when children were protected from sex, that women used to be available to their kids. And as you say, these are all different ideals, none of which existed in its stereotypical form, and none of which coexisted at the same time. In colonial days, certainly a man's home was supposed to be his castle, but in fact, neighbors and church officials intervened all the time. There was male dominance, yes, as so many fundamentalists want us to go back to, but they would be horrified by the sexual frankness of an age. This was an age when first grade readers used the word fornication as a good example of a four-syllable word. Similarly, then, some people think, well, let's go to the little women kind of division of labor between men and women, when women were totally available to their children. And the first thing you have to understand about that is that women could give up their older tasks of childcare and textile making in the middle class only because a new immigrant working class took that over, including children, took over those tasks. So childhood was lengthened in the middle class only by foreshortening it in the working class. But even in the middle class family, relations were very different than many moral conservatives would like to imagine, because that tremendous division of labor between men and women alienated women from men. They thought of men as much coarser. They found their most intimate and even sensual bonds with other women.
You say that the idea of the eroticized married couple comes from the 1920s.
Yes.
What happened then?
Well, in the early 1900s, a new ideal arose that put the family as the center of self-fulfillment. Prior to then, not only had there been larger political responsibilities associated with notions of morality and virtue, but the family itself was rather sternly defined as the place where character was built. It was not considered to be the place where you got all your emotional, sensual, and personal needs met. But in the 1920s, there was this new idea that the family would be the center of every emotional satisfaction and every erotic satisfaction that you have. It was a period where you had your first sexual revolution, every bit as shocking to contemporaries as that of the 1960s, but it was all channeled into the idea of this newly eroticized heterosexual relationship ending up in marriage. The result, of course, was what you might expect. The more emphasis you put on finding all of your personal, sensual, economic, every satisfaction in the couple relationship, the more intolerable a couple relationship that didn't work seemed to be. So it was also the 1920s that had this very sharp rise in divorce rates, and when the first demands for the legitimation of gay and lesbian unions were raised.
I think a lot of people who think back to a traditional family use the 1950s family as the model. I think in some ways that's the model that people are nostalgic for. But you think that the 1950s family really broke from the past, as opposed to the 1950s family being the most traditional of families.
The 1950s was neither traditional nor is it a model, if I may say so. First of all, it was a historical aberration. For the first time in 100 years, the age of marriage fell, the fertility rate rose, the divorce rate fell. We've had the highest divorce rate since 1889, not since 1969. And in this pro-family period that people think of as tradition, it was really probably the first time anyone had ever fantasized that families would be the absolute center of people's lives. So A, it was not traditional. B, it was not ideal. First of all, the ideal did not correspond to the reality of many people's lives. A third of American children were poor throughout the decade. 50% of black married couple families were poor. Even in the families that did live in the kind of suburban houses that were publicized in the sitcoms, in fact, that the sitcoms were designed to sell, not everything was as happy as people like to pretend. We're only now learning about the incest, the alcoholism, the abuse. Wife battering wasn't a crime. Even in less extreme cases, there was widespread marital dissatisfaction. Women were feeling so dissatisfied with their roles long before the feminist movement that the major word that news journalists were using about women by the end of the 1950s was trapped.
A lot of people look back to the sitcoms of the 50s and say, well, maybe it was a little exaggerated, but that's the way the family should be, you know, the nice nuclear family unit. You look back on the television of that period and say, well, this is when consumerism really started, and your critique of television then has more to do with appliances than it does with the perfect family unit.
Well, advertisers in magazines and TV shows often call their shows themselves or the editorial content of their magazines the wrapper for their real product, which is the products that are being sold in the advertisements. And I think that the 1950s family of the sitcoms was the wrapper for the hot point appliances and the GE electricity that was being sold by these shows. And that ironically, the 1950s family was the first time that we got an equation of happiness with consumerism.
The 1950s is also the first time that there's a teen market. And, you know, part of that teen market is the emergence of rock and roll.
Yes.
And of a whole rock and roll culture. So where does that fit into your analysis of the changes within the family in the 1950s?
Well, I'm not one of these people who thinks that all of the modern youth culture, individualism, and sexual revolution is a bad thing. But I think that the important point to make is that any excesses that it has have their roots in a consumer society that began in the 1950s. The 1960s was in many ways a reaction to that consumer society, an attempt to say that there's a lot of hypocrisy behind these families and there's too much materialism. The consumerism, the me-first gratification that so many conservatives like to be to blame on the 1960s, I think can be shown to have originated in the 1950s and to be very closely attached to the family value that they mistakenly hold up as the ideal tradition.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stephanie Kuntz. She's the author of the new book, The Way We Never Were, American Families and the Nostalgia Trap. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Stephanie Kuntz is my guest, author of the new book, The Way We Never Were, American Families and the Nostalgia Trap. When you look back through American history, is there a time that you would single out to describe as time that when family life was at its strongest?
I'm not sure how to ever answer a question like that, because it depends how you define family. It depends how you define strong. There are some people who think that the colonial family was at its strongest because male dominance was unchallenged. And after all, in those days, a man had the right to beat his wife so long as the stick was no bigger than his thumb. That's where our expression rule of thumb comes from. There are others who look back and say, well, okay, that was a little rough, perhaps, so let's take the strength of the mid-19th century family model. But I think that that a lot of this idealization of family life that you find in the Victorian family is part of the problem that we're finding today, not part of the solution.
How is it part of the problem?
Well, it developed as older traditions of political responsibility and nurturing began to break down, and the new liberal democracy of capitalism said considerations of altruism, interpersonal relations, pity, community custom, all of these are inappropriate in the market, in the law, and in political transactions. On the other hand, you know, we're human beings. We have to have these considerations. So what do we do with them? Well, emerging capitalist democratic theory said, let's put them all on the family. And women, in turn, were expected to bear the responsibility for all of them. So there was a polarization of previously diffused emotions and shared traits. All of the emotions that were no longer appropriate in public life were displaced onto the family. And I think that this is a problem rather than the solution because it so greatly and tragically restricts our definition of cooperation, of morality, of commitment, and caring. Even when Murphy Brown answered Quayle on the, you know, which you would think would be the left wing, right, the cultural elite answer to Dan Quayle's comments about single mothers, what did she say? She said, a family is the place where commitment, caring, and love takes place. Well, yes, in some ways, but in other ways, what a tremendously truncated definition of obligation, commitment, and caring, if the only way we can conceptualize it is in family terms.
I wonder what your perceptions are of the family today. We're in a time where marriage isn't essential. You can be unmarried and not be a social pariah. You can be married and be childless. A lot of people are divorced. A lot of single parents. More early teen pregnancy than perhaps ever before. You'd know more about the statistics. And you look around, and the conclusion a lot of people reach when they see that is the family has totally fallen apart.
People have this kind of doomsday scenario approach to the family that I think is very unrealistic. I think we have to recognize that there have been trade-offs. There have been gains and losses. There have been different trends coming from different parts of the culture and economy that have different effects. To illustrate that, some things have been a real increase in freedom. The fact that a woman can now, if she finds herself pregnant or she doesn't have a husband, she can consider responsibly whether she wants to have a child on her own or not, and then think through whether she can afford that, how she can find male role models. I think that's a step forward. I don't think we should go back to the old days when she couldn't do anything about it, or if she did get pregnant, there was that shotgun wedding. On the other hand, there are other trends that are less elements of choice and reasonable discussion and thought. Much of the teen birth rate that we see is not such a rational choice.
As you mentioned earlier, many people blame a lot of social problems we're having today on the decline of the family. What's your response to that?
I personally get rather outraged about that. I'm a family historian. I've studied families in a lot of times and places. I know that family arrangements and family histories have an impact on well-being, but I have never studied a time or a place where family structure was the major cause of poverty or wealth in a society. And yet today we have the new social Darwinism of the 1990s, which says we're not going to blame racism, we're not going to talk about changing jobs, structures, forget the fact of the deindustrialization of America. All of the problems we face are because of single mothers. Now, that is nonsense. It's hogwash. It doesn't hold up empirically. The vast majority of poverty in this country is caused by racial and job structures, not by family structures. You want to talk about the decay of our cities? President Bush blames the collapse of our cities on the collapse of the family. The reason Chicago almost drowned last spring was because of collapse of its tunnels, not its families. America now ranks 51st in the world in its investment in infrastructure. That, I think, are the kind of issues that are ignored when people turn around and say, use this convenient idea of saying, if you people would just get married, then you'd be fine.
You're a family historian. You're also a single mother. Have you, as a single mother, ever been anxious about the impact it would have on your child for you to raise your child single?
Well, I don't consider myself a single mother. I have parents who are involved. Christopher's father, who is remarried, have both been involved. I have students who are involved. We have fictive kin. I have stepbrothers. Fictive kin, yes. I have people who are not really related to us, but who act as cousins, uncles, brothers. So I don't consider myself a single mother. And I think the single mom, two-parent mom debate obscures the fact that, sure, it's hard to raise a child by yourself, but it's also hard to raise a child just with two people. There's an old African saying that it takes an entire village to raise one child. And there's a lot of truth in that. We all need to think about children in a much wider sense than we have done in recent years in this society.
Your last sentence in your new book about the history of the family is this: we may discover that the best thing we will ever do for our own families, however we define them, is to get involved in community or political action to help others.
Well, I find that as a mother and as a historian and as a daughter, that some of the most healthy family lessons that people learn have to do with when they get beyond their own little nuclear unit and go out to interact with others. As a mother, I know that some of my best times with my son have come when I have involved him in my family research or in my family work and have gone out and worked with other families, whether it's going to a soup kitchen to help serve soup, whether it's going out to interview other families. I remember as a daughter that my favorite memories of family life were when we would have people over who were active in the civil rights movement or the union movement, and we would sing those songs together, and nobody was worried about spending quality time with the kids. At a certain point, we'd all be put together in the same bed, and no parent would come in to give us these extra special goodnight stories, but they were wonderful, warm times because our family was teaching us the most important lessons families have to teach, and that is to go beyond, to move beyond your own family and reach out with trusting, cooperative relations with others. The one constant there is in human history is that the families that have worked well have been the families that have taught that.
Well, Stephanie Coons, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Stephanie Coons is the author of The Way We Never Were. She teaches at Evergreen State College in Washington. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.